Life After Stroke is a production of the Hang On to the Dream Foundation, the 501c3 nonprofit organization that helps kids and adults reach their goals in life. If these Life After Stroke programs are helpful to you, please consider making a tax-deductible donation to the Hang On to the Dream Foundation to assist the organization in its numerous outreach activities. For more information, just go to www.hangontothedream.org. And remember, no matter how hard things seem, hang on to the dream. This program is not to be used as a way to diagnose or treat any medical condition that you may have. Please consult your doctor or healthcare professional before making any changes to your current medical routine.
Stroke.
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 It comes out of the blue, sometimes without warning.
But those who survive it
should never lose hope. A stroke can be life-changing.
But it is also
a new beginning.
Because for all survivors, there is still a beautiful life after stroke.
Hey everybody, welcome to Life After Stroke. I'm Christopher Ewing. Today we're broadcasting from the Hang On to the Dream Theater in Hollywood, California. And first of all, you know, I just want to, again, I mentioned it in a previous episode. Thank you very much, everybody, for all of your very kind emails and phone calls about how you guys are enjoying the show and all the great information that the show has provided to all of you who may have had a stroke or you know someone that's had a stroke. And we've still kind of been doing our thing every week. Again, we have a stroke support group that happens every Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific time. Just go to the strokechannel.tv website and you can click there and get hooked up and logged in and all that kind of stuff. Wanted to kind of do something kind of like a recap, if you will. For those of you who have been listening to the show for a while, I had my stroke April 21st of 2018. And it was about, maybe like 6 months or so after my stroke that I started the Life After Stroke radio show. Really because I do voiceovers and commercials and host TV shows and stuff like that. And my speech was affected. My face was affected. Everything was just a mess, really. But I had to get my voice back and, you know, do my own little speech therapy. So I figured, you know, I'll do a radio show about stroke because I was learning all this great information from all the doctors I would meet and stuff like that through being in the hospital and rehab hospital and stuff like that. And I figured, you know, if I'm slurring and drooling and doing all kinds of weird things, people who are listening to a stroke show wouldn't so much wonder, like, what's wrong with this guy? Well, I had a stroke. So that was one of the ways that really helped me get my speech back and things like that. In the past 5 years, you know, if I knew then what I know now is kind of one of those things. And so what I thought I would do is kind of do like a series that I'm kind of calling Stroke 101, where I'm just kind of recapping and kind of going back and kind of revisiting some of the wonderful people that I've met over the past 5 years who, have just imparted so much great information to me and things like that. And not the least of which is my guest on today's show. One of these days, I just want to get through one episode without crying. So for all of you guys that listen, you know, I'm a crier, and I wish I could chalk it up to the stroke, but I've always been really an emotional person, really my whole life. But, one of the things that I will say is that when you have a stroke, you meet all kinds of people, obviously doctors and therapists, fellow stroke survivors, caregivers, and everything else. And in the journey of my stroke, I have to say I've met some really, really wonderful people over the past 5 years and some odd months. And not the least of which is a person who's on with me now. He was one of my first guests on one of my first podcasts. And, you know, you never know the impact that people will make on you when you first meet someone. You just meet somebody like, oh, okay, hey, nice to meet you. Yeah, come here. So who I'm talking about is Dr. Robert Darflinger. He was on, I think, maybe like episode 2, and it was a really great episode. I mean, a lot of you have written in. I think it's one of the most listened episodes because Dr. Darflinger really broke it all down for us. And, you know, since then, he's become one of my closest friends. We talk at least once a week. We text almost every day, and not even about stroke, just about crazy stuff, you know, stuff in the news and everything else. And not only that, you know, and I may have spoken about this. I know I've spoken about it in our support group. I don't know if I've ever mentioned it on the air because I don't even, maybe I haven't. But anyway, I'll mention it now. I don't call him Dr. Darflinger. I call him Superman, and he knows that. First of all, say hi, Superman.
Danny, I'm so honored to be here. Thanks for having me again, and I'm very blessed to have you as a brother.
Well,
and thank you for having me again on the show.
Well, okay, so now I'm going to tell everybody, because I'm going to call you Superman during the whole show. I know him, because that's just what I call you every day. And the reason I call him that is one day I was at one of the hospitals where we did our stroke support group from, which was the same hospital where Dr. Darflinger, a.k.a. Superman, was working at. And I was in his office, and we were just talking and stuff like that, and he got a call or a page or something, and he said, oh, hang on, I got to get this. And he said, oh, you know, I've got to go help one of my colleagues do a stroke. Do you want to come watch? And I was like, oh, wow, yeah, that'd be cool. You know, I had a stroke, but I'd never seen, you know, what happens during, you know, stroke surgery or anything like that. So I follow him down to the operating room, and I'm in this little side room looking through the windows. And it was the most interesting thing because, you know, Dr. Darflinger calls himself a thrombectomist, right? Am I saying it right?
Thrombectomy is the actual ischemic stroke treatment. I would say we neurointerventional. There's a lot of different terms for it. Nobody knows.
But your title, like what you are, like your title,
neurointerventional radiologist.
Okay, gotcha. And if you listen to the second episode of this whole series of Life After Stroke, he said basically I'm a plumber. And which basically is, you know, the doctor that does the surgery when he goes up through your groin and your up into your brain and pulls the clots out. And I had always let him get away with calling himself a plumber because it's like, okay, yeah, I guess you are kind of like a plumber. You're like Roto-Rooter and you pull the clot out and you get the blood flow going again. Okay, cool. Well, anyway, I'm watching him do this surgery and I actually saw him do two surgeries this evening, particular evening. One was you were filling an aneurysm, right? You were
an aneurysm.
Yeah, you're putting in this coil, as you call it, like a wire, and you can see it on the screen, like in live time. You see this little bubble, and you see this black-ish kind of thing start to fill in that little bubble. And there was one of the nurses in there that was, you know, that we were looking at the screen together, and she was explaining to me what you were doing. And you know, I'm just looking through a glass window. And to kind of paint the picture, everybody, there was a big giant TV screens hanging over the top of this person's body that's having this stroke or having this aneurysm filled or whatever. And so Dr. Darflinger and his colleagues are looking at this screen, and that's how they can kind of see where they're putting in the coil and how much they need to put in and everything else. Well, and I'm just like, wow, that's so fascinating. Well, then this announcement came over at this hospital. And I don't know, does this happen at every hospital where they say code stroke, doc?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Okay. All thrombectomy or primary stroke centers or comprehensive stroke centers. Yeah.
Gotcha. So this call comes over the loudspeaker that says, you know, code stroke, you know, code stroke. And so that's kind of to alert the stroke team that, hey, somebody's coming in who's potentially having a stroke. So by this point, Superman is almost done. He's, you know, kind of about to finish up this guy. And then they say code stroke. So that's the alert that somebody else is coming in now. So Superman says, you know, hey, you know what you guys want? You guys, you know, wrap this guy up. I'll go get the other room ready for the other person that's coming in. So then I watch him literally, you know, go into the phone booth, become Clark Kent, and then back into Superman, meaning changing his gloves and his clothes and getting everything. And then he runs in this other room and gets it prepared, and in comes this guy who's having a stroke. And now this guy is the one, he had a clot in his brain. So you're going up there pulling the clot out. And my whole point in this rant is that number one, and this is where he and I fight about this all the time, because he always says, man, you're doing so good with your show. And I'm like, man, I'm not saving lives. You're saving lives. No, no. So we go into this fight as like, who's cooler, you know? And so, I mean, my point is I'm watching total strangers race around to save another stranger's life. And it's just like God's work, man. It's just like, it's amazing. And so anyway, he goes in and he pulls the clot out of this guy's head. And I remember saying, hey, save the clot. Because, you know, because at some point somebody's saying, oh, there's the clot. They've got it. And so I remember you guys pulling it out, or you or somebody pulled it out, and it kind of went flying across the room. And then you guys collected it. And without sounding too gross, I hate to put it this way, but it looked like a giant booger. So anyway, When you were done, and you know, this guy's all good, he's going up to recovery and everything, and Dr. Darflinger comes over and he says, wow, you know, that was good. I was like, man, that's great, that's so crazy. He goes, yeah, you know, 12 minutes or something, but you know, we got to get it even shorter, you know, like time is brain and all this stuff. And I just looked at him, I remember saying with tears in my eyes, I said, dude, you are never allowed to call yourself a plumber again. You're freaking Superman, because you've just devoted your whole life to saving Metropolis. I mean, that's, and we talk about this all the time. So anyway, thank you everybody for letting me go into that little rant as to why I call him Superman. Like I said, you're going to hear me call him Superman through this whole episode right here, because he really is. I mean, he returns people back to their families, to their husbands, wives, kids. I mean, that ain't nothing but God's work, man. And you, as I've said to you many times, you could have any job in the world, but you chose to save people's lives. And I'm so proud of you. I'm proud to be your friend. And just good on you, man. So nothing you can do about it. There you go.
Chris, thanks. I don't even know what to say after that. You humble me. I said this before. I think I said it on episode 2. I wish my wife was listening. I speak for my callers. We feel very blessed that we're able to do this, and that the technology has gotten to the point where we can do this and help people. And
yeah,
I know that I'm very lucky that I trained under people who are so much better and smarter than me, and paved the way. And I'm feel very blessed to be able to do what we do. And
yeah,
when it works, it's beautiful. And fortunately, sure, it doesn't always work, but
well, more times than not, at least
trying to get better.
Sure, sure. And you know, one thing we'll talk about during this episode is kind of what you just alluded to now, which is the technology has gotten better, because just not too long ago, like 20, 30 years ago, you know, it was kind of like, well, you had a stroke, we'll do the best we can. You know, I mean, what you guys can do now with stroke is really amazing. And again, it's really just since like, you know, 2010 or something like that things started to get, you know, more in favor of us stroke survivors and things like that. So, but let's kind of start, you know, and again, you know, over the past 5 years, I've learned a lot and certainly learned a lot from you, but I'm going to ask you questions as if, you know, the person, and there are many listening to this right now who, you know, maybe have had a stroke. They're still in the hospital. Like me, I was still in the hospital. I was going to Dr. Google and Dr. YouTube trying to figure out what the heck happened. So I'm going to ask you questions as if I'm them, as if I'm that stroke survivor who's listening to this right now, who just had a stroke, or a loved one who just left the hospital from seeing their loved one, or on their way to the hospital and they're listening to this podcast now, and you know, they're wondering what the heck happened. So to kind of start this off, and it's really elementary, what the heck is stroke? And you know, we hear that word, but what really is happening in someone's brain when they're having a stroke?
Right. So so to start off with the basic, what is a stroke? It was it's a neurologic deficit caused in most cases by lack of blood flow to a particular part of the brain. If this deficit lasts for only minutes to hours, less than 24 hours, it's called a transient ischemic attack. But if it persists, then we actually call it a stroke. And stroke is a very broad term that we use, which includes both ischemia, meaning you're not getting blood flow, you're not getting oxygen to the brain, and there's also hemorrhagic, meaning there's types of bleeds that can happen in the brain, which we also put in the broad category of stroke. A few statistics: there's about 800,000 new cases of stroke every year, almost 130,000 deaths annually. It's the number 5 cause of mortality. It used to be number four cause of mortality, but we're actually saving more people. But unfortunately, saving everybody doesn't mean that they all come back to normal after we treat them. So it still remains the number 1 cause of major disability. And this is, you know, for people of the age of 44 to 65 plus, this cardiovascular disease is the number 1 cause of death and morbidity mortality in this country. And I think the last time we talked, it was about $40 billion, but it's almost doubled, about $80 billion worth of healthcare costs nowadays. Of course, that has to do with the increased cost of everything in the country, but it's still a significant cost. And that includes not only the medical costs, but includes the, you know, that people can't go back to work, or they can't walk anymore, right? So the major disability is a significant factor of that, even for the people that survive a stroke.
Hmm. Is it my imagination that, you know, I'm just kind of judging by the phone calls and the emails that I get from listeners, is stroke on the rise? I mean, it just seems like all of a sudden there's been like this little surge and, you know, my husband's in the hospital, my mom's, you know, dad, you know, is it getting higher or is it kind of my imagination?
No, it is. It is getting higher. A lot of that has to do with the aging population that we have. And in most countries, the populations are aging. So the prevalence is increasing. We're getting a little bit better at getting the word out for the preventative medicine, the blood pressure control, not smoking. Smoking has decreased, which is a major cause, you know, and then all the other risk factors, obesity, alcohol, drugs. So those things are getting better, but we are an aging population. So it's slowly increasing in terms of its prevalence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's kind of break it down kind of by category, if you will. So there's ischemic strokes, which are clots. There's hemorrhagic strokes, which are bleeds, like what I had. And then do you also lump in like AVMs and stuff like that in terms of, you know, the statistics
we
of
do.
Stroke?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So about 87% of strokes are ischemic, meaning that there's a sudden loss of blood flow and oxygen to the brain. That's the vast majority of strokes. Hemorrhagic is about 13%, and then that breaks down into a few different causes. You mentioned AVMs. One of the more common causes is blood pressure. That's high blood pressure. It is probably, presumably, that's what you had at least for some period of time when you had your bleed. That's a good area for a high blood pressure bleed. And then brain aneurysm, AVMs, and there's some other neurovascular diseases that can also cause stroke, tend to be on the lower end prevalence.
Mm-hmm. So kind of walk us through what is actually happening with an ischemic stroke, first of all, you know, since those seem to be the most prevalent types of stroke. Kind of what I'd like to do is kind of have you kind of break it down, like, you know, somebody who's listening right now either may have had an ischemic stroke or a loved one has, and they're like, okay, what actually happened as a result of this thing? I mean, what really went on inside the brain? So what happens when someone is having an ischemic stroke?
So there's a couple different ways that you can have an ischemic stroke. One of the most common is called an embolic stroke, meaning a clot from somewhere else in your body, most commonly the heart, breaks loose and it gets sent through your blood vessels and it gets up into your brain and then it blocks the main blood vessels to your brain. As the blood vessels go further out, they get smaller and smaller. So a big clot can be sent up into the brain, and then as the blood vessel gets smaller, the clot stops there and it blocks all of the blood. That's the embolic stroke, and that's actually a fair amount. Somewhere around 50% come from the heart, from the condition called atrial fibrillation. Is a very, very common cause of this, in which you have an irregular heartbeat, and your chambers, the four chambers of your heart, are not beating as concerted as they are supposed to. And there's a particular chamber in your heart where if that beating is not as concerted, the blood just kind of sits there statically. It doesn't move. And when blood doesn't move, as we know from cuts on our arms, the blood clots. And then eventually at some point you get a good heartbeat and it knocks that clot loose and then it heads north. That's called an embolic stroke, and that's a fair amount of them. There's also the thrombotic or in situ, is what we call it, meaning on site, essentially, strokes where we have atherosclerotic disease. Which is hardening of the blood vessels and narrowing of the blood vessels over time. All of us get a little bit of this. But if we have too much narrowing, there's a few things that can happen with that. One, if it's too narrow, then you're not getting enough pressure, you're not getting enough flow, or what we call perfusion, to the brain. So just that narrowing, even if there's not a clot, can cause a stroke by not getting enough flow to that side of the brain or that particular part of the brain. There's also that atherosclerotic plaque that we have. It's really, if you imagine a garden hose and this plaque is building up along the walls of the garden hose, right? The plaque itself is composed of a fibrous cap over the top of it, like a mound of hill that's on the top of the inside of the garden hose. And in the inside, there's a lipid core. Okay. And in some cases, that fibrous cap gets disrupted or ulcerated, and the lipid core gets exposed to our blood. And that's a very thrombogenic source, that lipid core. and it immediately clots off.
Hmm.
So you can have the you can have that happen inside the blood vessels of your brain, or very commonly you can have that happen inside the carotid artery in the neck, which is the most common place to develop the atherosclerotic disease. So in the neck, you can have both things happen. If you have that atherosclerotic disease and all of a sudden it closes off, it can also throw the clots into the brain, or it can just close off the carotid artery in the neck by immediate occlusion. And so those are the most common causes of the ischemic.
And then, so when someone comes in to the hospital, you guys need to do a CAT scan, MRI, all that stuff. You say, oh, he's having an ischemic stroke. And then they wind up on your table, right?
So if somebody comes in with symptoms that are symptoms of stroke, which are most commonly, not always, but most commonly, they're what we call localizing or focal symptoms, meaning you can localize if they're paralyzed on the left side of their body, for example, then that would be referred to the right side of the brain, right? So if they come in with symptoms of a stroke, which is most commonly going to be numbness on one side, no sensory, or not able to move that side, or their face is drooping, or they have slurred speech, which we call dysarthria, which is very different than dysphagia, which is the inability to interpret speech. Mm. But if they come in with those symptoms and approach it to any hospital or to the ambulance, essentially, the ambulance is going to take them to a primary stroke center, at the very least, if not a comprehensive stroke center, whatever's closest. And then they will get evaluated and immediately go for a non-contrast CAT scan. And that's used to determine whether it's a bleed or a tumor, perhaps. Sometimes those symptoms can manifest as a stroke. But the non-contrast head CT determines essentially whether it's a bleed or not a bleed. Okay. Mm-hmm. If it's a bleed, it goes down a different pathway. If it's not a bleed and it appears to be a stroke, then the first thing they will do is give you a medication to try and break up clots. Even if they don't see the clot yet, they give that medication right away once there's no bleed.
And that's TPA.
After that, they do... So there's it's TPA in a lot of places. That's tissue plasminogen activator. That's kind of the older medication. A lot of places have moved on to tenecteplase, which has a little bit better medical profile, but not everybody's on there. And then once that medication is given, then they do another CAT scan with what we call contrast, an iodinated contrast that's designed to look at the blood vessels and to see if we can find the clot.
Mm-hmm.
Once that's done, if a clot is identified, then we start to move down the pathway of doing a thrombectomy, which is where we need to go in and take the clot out. There's some variation. If you're within a certain period of time, within 6 hours, that CAT scan designed to look at the blood vessels that identify the clot is enough. And then they would call somebody like me and my team would come in and we would take you to the operating room to pull out the clot. If people are over 6 hours, then we do a little bit more advanced studies to determine how much injury is already there and how much tissue there is to preserve. And that difference between the injured tissue and the tissue that's available to be saved, the tissue that's at risk for further injury, we call it a penumbra. And as long as the numbers work out that there's more tissue to save and not so much tissue that's already injured, then we'll go down the same pathway to go pull the clot out.
Hmm.
And that's changing too with the newer studies. We're actually going after a lot more patients, even if they have large injury, because there's been some studies that show they still benefit.
So there was kind of like a cutoff time where you wouldn't go in to take a clot out. Like if it was beyond a certain amount of time, it was like, you know what, don't bother because already so much damage has been done. Was that kind of the train of thought then?
Correct. So you mentioned in the 2010 time frame, and in 2013. There were a series of, in my opinion, very bad studies that seemed to show that there wasn't any benefit to go after the clot, even though a lot of us knew there was benefit. And when those studies came out, it essentially became we couldn't do these procedures to pull the clot out anymore. Insurance wouldn't pay for it, and you know it was against the evidence that was available. But all of us knew that wasn't the real data, and part of that. is because there was a new device that had come out in that period of time. And that new device was very good at pulling clots out. 85, 90% success rate in pulling clots out. And that device was so good that everybody immediately started using it. And when those initial three trials came out, which included a large number of patients, only six patients were included that had the new device. And the reason for that is that those of us, and this was when I was getting into the field, so this was not me, but the great people before me, they knew that this device was so good that they would not put the patients in those trials. So the trials would say medical management versus the device, versus the thrombectomy, versus the procedure. And they knew that this was such a good advance in the field that they didn't want to put their patients into the trial and have them randomized to the medical management. Okay, so the data was corrupted right off the bat. But once those trials came out, we were pretty much eliminated from being able to do these procedures. And so we had to come up with a trial that demonstrated the efficacy of this procedure. And this is something I always talk about when I talk about stroke. Those trials that we then had to do to prove the efficacy of this procedure were mostly done at academic centers all around the world. And there was a colleague of mine who was in one of these trials. This was, again, right when I was getting into it. And you could not do this procedure to pull a clot out unless you participated in the trial, which means you had to randomize people, which is a little bit of an ethical dilemma, right? Because you know that the patient is going to do better by pulling a clot out, but you can't do it unless you allow them to be randomized to the medical arm as well. And this person had a very strong memory of a young woman who had just given birth a few days before. And she had a stroke and she had a clot and she got randomized to the medical management. And she subsequently passed. And I think it's always important to think about those people who volunteered to be part of these trials.
Gave their life to the cause.
And literally they sacrificed themselves on the altar of medicine so that we would all be better for it. And we need to remember those people. And I think it's very important.
Absolutely.
But once those trials came out, it was undeniable that this was the best treatment for stroke and the gold standard.
To think that all of this was happening just 2013. I mean, it's 15. just 2015.
Well, there was five big trials that came out in 2015 demonstrating. They were all stopped early.
Wow.
Because the efficacy of treatment was so good. We've been doing stroke for a lot longer than that, but the devices were not as good. We weren't able to get the clot out. You know, initially it started, we would put little tiny tubes up and just drizzle that TPA, which is called urokinase earlier, but we would just go up there and drizzle the medication to try and break up the clot. And then there was a couple different variations on the devices to try and pull clots out, but they really weren't all that great. That device was called a stent retriever. It's kind of a wire basket that you deploy into the clot, and then you pull the clot out. And
that's
I don't remember
I
exactly when that came out. It was right around the 2010, 2011, 12 timeframe. But they weren't included in the unfortunate trials of 2013. So it wasn't until 2015 that those five major trials came out that utilized that device and showed an unbelievable benefit by taking the clot out.
Yeah, and so that's my point. It's kind of like, man, just in the past 8 years, you know, there's been all this. But prior to that, I mean, it was just a little bit short of a crapshoot as to how well you were going to do. I mean, like, if you had a stroke in, like, the 70s and 80s and even way before that, it was kind of like, well, we'll do what we can, you know. It's just amazing that it is just this recent that some of the progress that has happened in the stroke world has happened just in the past few years, you know?
Yeah, it really is pretty recent that it became so good. And it continues to get better. And part of those five trials that came out, as a standard, we would look at a six-hour window from somebody from what we call the last known well or the last known normal when they were perfectly normal. And if it was after 6 hours, the idea was that it had been too long. And there's too much injury and there's risk of bleeding, right? So even if you take the clot out, that person's not completely out of the window at that point, because there's a risk of the injured tissue bleeding into itself, right? Mm-hmm. And so we used some of the data from the medications and the risk of bleeding, what we call hemorrhagic conversion. And at that time, it was 6 hours was kind of the time frame that we used for when we could treat stroke and when we would not treat stroke if it was after 6 hours. And a lot of that was based on bleed rates because of the medications. But in those five trials, which looked at 6 hours, there were a couple patients, there was enough patients included that were over 6 hours to suggest, not to prove, but to suggest that maybe we could do this even after 6 hours. And so it wasn't enough to make it the standard of care, but it was enough to start some more trials. And there were two trials after that called Dawn and Diffuse trial that looked at extended, what we call extended window period, looking up to 24 hours. And there's a little bit more criteria that we use for those patients, but now it's the standard of care to treat at least up to 24 hours based on those trials. Again, those trials were all stopped early because of the efficacy and the benefit of treating up to 24 hours far outweighed not treating in certain circumstances. There's a little bit more criteria for those patients, but that's actually changing now too. Now we're looking at larger stroke volumes, even intervening on and perhaps even after 24 hours.
So now my stroke brothers and sisters who are listening to this right now all over the country and around the world who are laying in a hospital bed, they had an ischemic stroke. They had someone like you go in and pull that clot out. What actually took place during that surgery? How does that whole thing unfold and all that? So they wind up on your table and then what happens?
So it's all really based on imaging and clinical criteria. Again, the time frame and identifying a clot on the CAT scans. And in some cases, determining how much injury there already is versus how much is at risk. Once all that's determined and they meet the criteria by the literature, by the evidence-based medicine, then they call somebody like me, and we call in our team, and that person is taken to the OR, and they're put on a table, and we, in most places, still go through the femoral artery. So both of their groins are prepped and clean, and then a big sterile drape is placed over their body. And we give them some medications to kind of relax them, but we don't want to put them under anesthesia because that lowers the blood pressure. And at that point, we really want their blood pressure to kind of be a little bit higher to help the rest of the brain try to feed that area that's not getting its perfusion, right? So they're awake for these procedures in most cases, not all, if they're unable to completely state, you know, if they're not. So I've done procedures on people who are moving around quite a bit, but the more they move around, it becomes more dangerous. So if they're not holding still to a certain degree, then we have to put them to sleep. But in most cases, people are awake. And then we put some tubes into the artery in their leg, the femoral artery. And we feed a series of tubes up into the neck. And first we take pictures. We inject a contrast that fills up the carotid artery or vertebral artery if it's in the back of that. And that fills up the blood vessels and we take pictures with the x-ray. And that picture will show us where the blood, in this case the contrast, is going up the blood vessels and all of a sudden it stops. And it's not filling the rest of the blood vessels. And that's where the clot is. And if the clot is still there, then we put even smaller tubes through the big tubes in the neck and we feed those tubes all the way up to the clot, and then we have a couple different devices now that to take it out. One of them is that the mainstay really is that stent retriever that I mentioned, but there's also some increasing use of better catheters to put right up to the clot and just suck it out. And each operator has their preference of where they start, but essentially we can pull clots out within, and, you know, in a lot of cases within 10, 15 minutes, if everything is going well.
So amazing. You know, and it's even amazing to think that you could go from the groin up into the brain, you know, like, you know, I've said it a few times where it's kind of like, you know, for those of you out here in California, you know what I mean by this. It's like getting on the 405 to the 134 to the 101. And, you know, it's like you're going from one little highway to another and somehow you find yourself there and you get it out, you know, and, It's just amazing. So, you know, one of my other questions is, you know, we have a couple of people in our stroke support group who actually had two strokes. One, you know, like for those of you that listen all the time, you know, Dr. Parker, our favorite, I mean, he's just such a great guy. He had two strokes. He had one in the parking lot of the coffee house, his favorite little coffee house. And, you know, they called an ambulance and they got him to the hospital. And then he had a second stroke in the hospital, like 2 a.m. And that turned out to be the big daddy of all strokes for him. Why would a second stroke happen and be so catastrophic on top of that even? You think once you make it to the hospital, you're good now. But, you know, bad things can happen. And it's not obviously through the fault of the hospital. But what happens in the brain that second stroke could happen when you think you're home free?
Yeah, so I would say that the repeat strokes are not as common because in most cases, if somebody actually had a stroke or a TIA and went to the hospital, in most cases, certainly primary stroke centers and what we call thrombectomy centers and comprehensive stroke centers, they're going to be evaluated by whether or not they see me, whether or not I have to pull the clot out. Either way, they're going to see a vascular neurologist in a lot of cases, and they're going to try to figure out where that stroke came from, right? They're going to put people on a heart monitor to see if they have atrial fibrillation. Did it come from the carotid artery disease? They're going to try to find that. A lot of times we can't find exactly where it happened, but in most cases, they're going to be put on a medical regimen that's going to be preventative for stroke. So the repeat stroke, it does happen, but it's not terribly common.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but why is the second stroke worse than the first stroke? Well, as we've talked about before, it kind of depends on how big the branch is that's occluded, and what area of the brain that's supplying. And as we've talked about, there are some I kind of think of the brain as real estate. There are some places that you can have a very big stroke with very minimal changes to you, right? That I would call that Fresno. It's very
You've talked
territory.
About that with me because, yeah, I know.
Right.
Yeah.
But then there's unfortunately some areas where even a very small stroke can cause devastating effects, and that would be Malibu.
Mm.
And so it kind of depends on where the first stroke was and where the second stroke was and whether it cleared quick enough. It's not very easy to always predict that, but that could be why. But in most cases, after somebody has had a stroke, so the real problem is particularly with transient ischemic attacks. So if somebody's having a heart, we've gotten really good at heart attacks in America, but that makes sense because if somebody's having crushing chest pain and they can't breathe, these are things they can't ignore, and they immediately go to the hospital. And then the cardiologists open up the vessel or do whatever they have to do to improve the blood flow to the heart. But that crushing chest pain makes them go. The problem in a lot of times with strokes and TIAs is that people ignore it, right? Mm-hmm. So if you had slurred speech for a half an hour, 40 minutes, and then it went away, none of us really want to go to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But so we just ignore it. Right, that the risk of having a stroke after a transient ischemic attack is enormous, and so one of the things we're trying to get out through in medicine in general, we're trying to get out is that once you've had this, you're not okay. You need to go get looked at, and get on the right medical management.
Yeah, you bring up a good point on that because one of our visitors to one of our stroke support groups a couple years ago, their mom contacted me and said, "Hey, you know, I live on the East Coast. My son is out there in California somewhere. And, you know, I'd love to get him into your support group because he had a stroke." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, no problem." So I told him the time and everything. And she kind of told me what happened as a result of his stroke. So for all you young cats out there, you know, you got to pay attention to this kind of stuff. He was at his house or a friend's house, a bunch of people hanging out, all partying or whatever. And he fell in the middle of the kitchen and was stroking out, but all of his friends thought he was just drunk. So they took him and put him to bed. And so now he's in bed Well, now the next morning, everybody kind of wakes up with a hangover and they're all, oh man. And they open up the door to check on him and they say, oh, he's still sleeping. So they shut the door some more and just left him there. He was basically having a stroke for 18 hours before, you know, like around noon when he finally didn't wake up. They're like, oh man, maybe something serious. And then they called the hospital, you know, called 911. And it turned out he had been having a stroke all along. He was not drunk. It wasn't, you know, he didn't fall in the middle of the kitchen because he was drunk. He fell in the middle of the kitchen because he was having a stroke. So that's why, you know, it's interesting how you say, you know, it's all about educating people on this because, you know, it could be anything. And like you said, you know, people have a crushing pain in their chest. They're instantly, you know, calling 911. But, you know, and to my own defense, I don't know that I would have called 911 with my stroke. I mean, I had a hemorrhagic stroke. And, you know, I remember you asking me if I had like crushing headache or anything like that. And, no, I was just confused. I couldn't talk. Like I knew I was talking, like I'm talking to you right now. I knew I was saying something, but I was like, I don't know if I'm making any sense right now, but I'm just being silly. And I was just going to write it off. And I kept trying to talk. And then finally somebody said, okay, something right with you, man. You okay? And then I was like, oh shoot, I guess something is wrong. My point is had I been alone, I probably would have just gone and laid down and probably would have died because hemorrhagic strokes are the most deadly.
Yeah, they're definitely terrible. And you know, that alcohol, that is a very confounding, that's a classic story. And unfortunately I've had patients that I got called way too late and it was a similar story. I can remember one, it was a 19-year-old and I followed him for a couple of years, but he laid down, he just fell down on the floor and him and his friends were drinking and they left him on the floor. And by the time he got in, he had a major stroke. And the alcohol is very confounding. And it actually ended up in some litigious law, you know, some lawsuits in medicine if it's not identified. And but unfortunately it's very difficult. But so I think that's where the outreach comes out, and really the TIAs, these are the things, and it's hard to reach those people, right? We can't reach out to the people who are in the risk factor because they won't, like you said, you would have just gone into your room. What we have to reach out to is the children or the grandchildren, the people who are in the highest risk factors.
Because those are the first responders. Those are the ones that are sitting there saying, oh, you know, exactly. You know, dad, mom, grandma, grandpa, you don't look too good. You know, and that's why I kind of went on this little rant and interrupted you while you were speaking, was that I hear this all the time, you know, about young people that have strokes, because you wouldn't assume that somebody in their late teens or 20s or something like that would be having a stroke. So you're, of course, if you're sitting around smoking pot or hanging out drinking or whatever, you're going to assume that if, you know, Johnny's laying in the middle of the kitchen floor, that it's not a stroke. I mean, that's the last thing you think of, because you wouldn't think that he would be of that age group that would have a stroke. But that age group is any age group. I mean, I've literally, as people have heard on the show, I've met people who had a stroke in their mother's womb. So the age group, you know, stroke is no respecter of age, you know?
No, I mean, fortunately, it is true that it's less often in the younger age groups, but it does still happen. And that's obviously devastating. And if there's been signs, if there's been a TIA, you know, a TIA, 5% of patients will suffer a stroke within the next 2 days after a TIA. And something like, I think it was like 11% within the next 3 months. And then, you know, stroke, 38% of them, almost 40% were less than 65 years old. So you're right. We think of it happening in only the octogenarians, but that's just not the case.
So now I've got to be a little selfish. Let's talk about my hemorrhagic brothers and sisters, those of us who don't get as much attention because we are such a small segment of the stroke population, although we're the most, you know, the ones who die the most, because I guess it's what, 50% of us die in the first few days. Those of us who've had a hemorrhagic stroke, I mean, it's the most severe kind of stroke. Talk a little bit about that. What's happening in our brain?
Yeah, so the hemorrhagic strokes, that's where you're bleeding into the brain or around the brain. The number one cause of that is hypertension or high blood pressure. And what happens in very typical areas in the brain where the very small vessels, we call them perforating arteries often, the very small vessels that can't handle the high blood pressure, and then they just rupture outright. Not an aneurysm. There wasn't anything wrong with the blood vessel, but the blood pressure is just too high for it to handle. And that, the area that you had it, is very classic. And I know you didn't seem to have blood pressure before, so I'm not saying that it was, but it is a classic area to have a hypertensive hemorrhage. So and this goes along with good health maintenance, checking your blood pressure when you get to a certain age. And again, this is going to, you know, high blood pressure starts to occur kind of middle age. It depends. Some of us have a predisposition to this, but kind of when we get middle age, that's when we need to start paying attention to that a little bit more. Sleep apnea is a big cause of having high blood pressure. Certainly smoking, drinking, alcohol is the number one cause of younger people having high blood pressure. And so that's the number one cause of a hemorrhagic stroke. The other two causes, aneurysm would be probably next in line. And an aneurysm is essentially the weakness in a wall of a vessel. So again, if you think of a garden hose and there's a weakness in the wall of that garden hose, and then the vessel kind of pouches out, and then that's a weaker wall of the vessel. And then that can rupture. And about a third, a little bit less, but about a third of patients who have a ruptured aneurysm never make it to the hospital. And then a third who do make it to the hospital and get treated will still have some kind of deficits. And then a third will recover after treatment. Those numbers are old, and I think it's a little bit higher now for the people who make it to the hospital and recover without a deficit, but that's a general rule. And then you mentioned arterial venous malformations or AVMs. That's more rare, but again, that can also cause the same thing. And then there's some other neurovascular causes that are even less common.
Yeah, now in the AVMs, I kind of describe it as like your brain looks like a plate of spaghetti where all the blood vessels are just kind of there, and one of them has a little kink in it, and that's the source that then becomes the stroke, pretty much, right?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So that's a great way to describe it, a plate of spaghetti. It's an abnormal connection between the arteries and veins. So if you get down to a basic anatomy and physiology, the arteries take the blood to the brain, and they get smaller and smaller as they perforate into the tissue until they get to the capillary level. And the capillary level is where the cell exchange and the oxygen and gas exchange occurs. And by that division of the blood vessels into the capillary phase, the blood pressure is dissipated so that it's at the appropriate range for gas and nutrient exchange, right? And then it becomes the venules instead of the arterioles. So after the capillary, you have very, very small veins that get bigger and bigger and bigger until the vein drains that area of tissue. An arterial venous malformation is when that normal division of blood vessels from arteries to the veins has been disrupted, and you have a tangle of arteries that go directly into the veins, and so you don't have that dissipation of the blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Not all arterial venous malformation, so you end up with high blood pressure on the venous side, the high flow lesion. So instead of making its way, if you think of like a river that's going into small little creeks and then remeets and becomes the outflow of that river into the ocean, we've skipped that part, and now we just have some connections of very high pressure, high flow arteries that go directly into the venous system, and that can result in a few different things. One, they can result in high pressure on the veins, which are not supposed to have it, and that's believed to be part of the bleeding factor. Those veins under high pressure can change, and they can be, because of that high pressure, they can have areas where there's narrowing, because they're not supposed to have that pressure, and that narrowing restricts that high flow, and that can contribute to bleeding, we think. And then that high flow can also cause aneurysms. So you can have aneurysms that are related, what we call feeding artery aneurysms, to the arterial venous malformation, and those can rupture as well. We're not terribly great at predicting AVMs and which ones will rupture or not. There's many people that have AVMs, and they've had them their whole life, and they'll never bleed. And then there's other people that have AVMs, and they bleed. And some of those things that I just mentioned, we think are the risk factors. We call them high-risk features of an AVM, so venous outflow narrowing or an aneurysm. We would call those high-risk features. But not everybody with an AVM bleeds, and not everybody with an AVM needs to be treated for it. But we do generally follow it.
And I remember you talking about territory, like where you have your stroke, you know, especially like in my case, you were saying how, you know, mine unfortunately was in Malibu, where there's some parts of your brain that if you have something happen there, you're not going to lose too much. It's, you know, would you, I think you, in my case, you had said there's Bakersfield and there's Malibu, you know, it's like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it big, right? You know, so it is what it is. And so that's interesting. And can you, be as a result of that, kind of predict what type of deficit someone's going to have going forward as a result of that?
We do. There's a classification system for the arterial venous malformations that takes into account the size of the vascular malformation, what the venous drainage looks like, and then what location in the brain it is. And that's it's really a surgical classification for what the risks of treatment would be for that. And in general, we tend in a lot of places not to treat AVMs unless they are causing symptoms. Either they bled or they cause seizures, which they can cause, or otherwise have some other symptoms that are occurring as related to that. Most of those that don't have symptoms, we tend to follow. If they have symptoms, then it becomes kind of a risk-benefit, evaluation based on that classification system. One of the parts of that classification, directly what you're talking about, one of the parts of that classification system is whether it's an eloquent brain or not, meaning very high-functioning brain, essentially, the Malibu territories. Right, so if it's in an area that's not eloquent, right, it doesn't control your speech, doesn't control your movement, then the risk of surgery in that area is presumably lower.
Okay, see, that's what's kind of crazy, because it's like you've got ischemic strokes, and then mine being a hemorrhagic stroke, and then you've got an AVM kind of thing where people could go their whole life and not have any problem with that little kink in there and little blockage or whatever. It's just, I remember somebody saying a few years ago, I heard a doctor say, if you've seen one stroke, you've seen one stroke, like they're just so all individual.
There's certainly some truth to that. We treat quite a bit here, but everyone, you have to address it as its own entity.
Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want you to kind of walk us through some steps of what we can do to kind of prevent a second stroke from happening going forward. I mean, once we've had one, we're kind of a little bit on the firing line of having others. And then how we can better kind of educate people about stroke. I mean, maybe some people that are listening to this, probably most people that are listening to this, is because they either had a stroke or they know someone that did. But I'm sure there's probably some people who are listening to this who haven't had a stroke. They just kind of stumbled upon this maybe or something. And so on the other side of the break, I'd like for you to kind of walk us through what more could be done in terms of educating people about stroke and the importance of knowing about it and being on top of it. So everybody sit tight, and we'll be right back. Life After Stroke is a production of the Hang On to the Dream Foundation, the 501c3 nonprofit organization that helps kids and adults reach their goals in life. If these Life After Stroke programs are helpful to you, please consider making a tax-deductible donation to the Hang On to the Dream Foundation to assist the organization in its numerous outreach activities. For more information, just go to www.hangontothedream.org. And remember, no matter how hard things seem, hang on to the dream. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Life After Stroke. I'm Christopher Ewing. Today, we're talking about a series that I'm kind of calling Stroke 101. We're kind of going back to some of the earlier information that we put together when I first started this podcast, about 5 years ago. With us is one of my favorite people in the whole wide world, and he knows it, and there's nothing he can do about it. It is Dr. Robert Darflinger, a.k.a. Superman, and he is kind of... kind of educating us on what really happens when someone's having a stroke and the different dynamics that all go into a stroke and some of the procedures that are done as a result of the stroke and so forth. And, you know, I also want to give a shout out. You know, I tour the country. I speak a lot at stroke conferences and all kinds of stuff. And I just want to give a little shout out to my new friends that I met in Green Bay, Wisconsin a couple weeks ago. They invited me to come and be their keynote speaker during their community stroke day. And so I just want to show you guys some love and just say hi. It was really great meeting everybody. Love you guys. I hope everything's going good. And, you know, Doc, kind of walk us through a little bit in terms of we've had the stroke. Is there anything that we can do to kind of stave off the possibility of having a second one? Because as I've kind of learned along the way that once you've had one, I mean, you're not necessarily guaranteed to have another one, but you're a little more likely to have another one than someone who's never had one at all.
Yeah, that's correct. I think I would start off by saying there's kind of the pre-stroke, how to prevent a stroke, and then there's the post-stroke treatment. And a lot of this is going to be medical management. And again, I am just a plumber. I know you don't like when I say that, but really, if it's leaking, I stop it. If it's clogged, I open it. And a lot of the rest of this medical management is a little bit out of my bailiwick, but
I get it.
In general, the pre-stroke area, that's where it's the good living and you know, making sure that you're following up with your primary care physician. Certainly as we get older, we all need to do that. All things in moderation, alcohol, right? Smoking, terrible. Any other illicits, obviously, which I doubt any of your listeners are doing. Mm. But it's the kind of good living, healthy exercise, all that kind of stuff. That's the preventative, and then going to your physician and making sure that your blood pressure is well controlled. You know, if you have sleep apnea, wearing your mask, right, at night, and doing all those things to prevent the worsening of the risk factors. Once you've had a stroke, the post-stroke care, in most cases, is going to be pretty well regimented by your physicians, in particular, either your primary care physician or hopefully a neurologist that you've seen after a stroke. And they're going to, right immediately after the stroke, the first step is to try to figure out where the stroke came from, whether it was the carotid artery or intracranial atherosclerotic disease or atrial fibrillation, all of these things. They're going to maximize your medical care. And probably the best thing that you can do is be compliant with that medication or with that regimen. And a lot of people aren't. So if you've had high blood pressure and you've had a stroke, now's the time that you have to stick to those blood pressure medications, right? If you've had a stroke and your doctors have determined that you need to be on the whatever blood thinner, whether it's aspirin or whether it's stronger medications, something like Plavix, or if it's even stronger blood thinners, like warfarin, Coumadin, Eliquis, Pradaxa, any blood thinners for your heart, you got to stick with those medications. And that's really the best thing that you can do to prevent the second stroke.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've had people join our support group who said that, you know, boy, they're so afraid of having a second stroke. Should someone who's had one stroke be so, you know, not necessarily crazy about it, but should we really worry about having a second stroke? I mean, is it almost like a given?
That's
that
a
we're
really good
have
question.
One?
No, I wouldn't say it's a given, but you're at a higher risk. So the risk factors need to be well managed, right? But there's a fine line, because there's another thing that happens with stroke where you can get this anxiety or get even a depression or a stress from having had that stroke, whether it's an aneurysm or an ADM or an ischemic stroke. These are very traumatic things for us. Mm-hmm. And even people who recover perfectly physically, as you can see, or, you know, from a direct observational, they recover perfectly. They can have some symptoms of depression or traumatic stress disorder. This is a very traumatic thing. It's not an uncommon thing for those to occur. So there's a fine line between that and making sure that you're paying good attention to your health. Right. I think once you've had a stroke, you have to acknowledge that you had the stroke, and you have to acknowledge that there's some limitations in terms of you can't be flippant about it, right? You have to continue to have your doctor's appointments. You have to continue to monitor your blood pressure. You have to continue to monitor your blood sugars if you're diabetic. It's more of a wake-up call that that this is the new you. And that doesn't mean you should panic and not live your life. Mm-hmm. It just means you have to acknowledge that, that's part of your new life.
Sure. Sure.
Did that, I don't know if that answered the question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, you know, one of the things that also comes up in our stroke support group, you know, certainly just the difference in deficits that happen after Frank's stroke versus Susie's stroke. You know, it's like we all had a stroke. However, you know, we all have different ramifications as a result of that stroke. And also, you know, like with my situation, when I got out of the hospital and out of the rehab hospital after that, I went to my cardiologist for a checkup. And I think it was like maybe 3 months after my stroke. And he was like, man, when we heard you had a stroke, we were like shocked because, you know, your blood pressure was borderline. He said, but I got guys coming in here that should be dead. Their blood pressure is so high, but they've never had a stroke. You know, so it's kind of like, how do you predict this kind of stuff, number one? And then, you know, number two, in my case, you know, where you've said that, you know, the location of my stroke was in Malibu versus, you know, Bakersfield or something where, you know, the location of my stroke was, you know, very, which I think just, it was just a bad location. It's like a location where you just don't want to have a stroke, you know, in the basal ganglia. And, you know, I have no balance anymore. I mean, I can walk, but, you know, my 90-year-old mother could push me over in a heartbeat, you know, just because I have no balance. And it's just so weird how people have different, you know, issues after their stroke, to the point where some can't laugh, can't cry, can't, you know, move certain limbs, you know, all kinds of stuff. And then there's some you could look at and think, well, there's nothing wrong with you. I've even heard some stroke survivors have been kind of offended by the fact that someone will say to them, well, you don't look like you had a stroke, but they really did have a stroke. It's just that, you know, they're not limping. They can move all fingers and toes, you know, don't discredit what's happened to them just because you visually can't see it. I mean, it's, you know, it's real. It's real, and they really had it, and they're really suffering with it. And, you know, obviously, you know, we're all in this together and praying for our brothers and sisters to get better from it. So it's just so crazy. Oh, yeah. The other thing that's really weird, talk a little bit about this. Sometimes people who have left brain strokes, so it'll knock out their right side, and in many cases, it'll affect their speech. So, I mean, most, and you, Lord knows, you're the smartest person in the room, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I've understood that in most cases, people have a left brain stroke, and it's if it's severe enough, it'll knock out their speech. However, it will not knock out the speech of some people who have a left brain stroke if they were born left-handed.
Yeah, so in the vast majority of us, we're right-handed. And the left side of the brain is what we call the dominant hemisphere, and that's where your major speech centers are. Mm-hmm. You have the speech centers on both sides, but in most of us that are right-handed, the dominant is the left. In some people that are left-handed, some people, because even in left-handed people, the majority of them also still have a left-sided dominance. But mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, I'm reaching out here, but I think it's about 15% of them have a right-sided dominance, and so they can have a left brain infarct or a stroke, but it won't affect their speech as well.
Hmm.
But I think that's only about 15% of people who are left-handed.
Yeah, I've heard that it's a very low percentage.
I may be wrong on those numbers, but yeah, the majority, even left-handed people, it's still left mm-hmm. brain dominant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just interesting because sometimes I've met people who have had a left brain stroke, their right side is blown out and their speech is just as clear. And I've said to them, I said, you know, were you born left-handed? Like, oh yeah, how'd you know? I was like, oh, you know, it's so weird and eerie. And is that because their speech center primarily was moved over to the right side of their brain when they were born, or like you said, it was more dominant on the right side, and because that side wasn't affected, they dodged that bullet?
You're getting into much more embryologic genesis than I have the knowledge for.
Man, you're Superman.
I'm not exactly sure why.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot that we don't understand. I think mm-hmm. there's people that will speak two languages, mm. And then they have a stroke, and then they revert back to their old language, right? And right. So there's a lot that we just still don't understand.
Gosh, it's so weird.
I don't know the answer to why.
Yeah. It's like, so
some
weird.
People have the right dominance and not.
Right. So, you know, Superman, take us home. So what can people do? And I guess we'll even start with people who have had a stroke, Well, you've kind of spoken about that. Just really just, you know, listening to your doctor and medicinal management and staying on your meds and doing all that kind of stuff. What can we do to kind of make sure that we kind of educate those around us? You know, for instance, you know, some of our caregivers, I mean, this is, you know, shout out to the caregivers. I mean, you know, I often say that when somebody has a stroke, the whole family has a stroke. It literally affects the entire family. And not obviously not just the stroke survivor themselves, but the caregiver. So you've got the husband or the wife who now has to earn a 4-year degree in PT and OT and ST, you know, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy all within 3 weeks. You know, by the time their loved one's kicked out of the hospital, you know, they now have to, you know, try to learn how to help this person walk, talk, and wave again. You know, just how it just really turns the entire family and everything upside down. What can we do to try to help ourselves as stroke survivors, help our caregivers, and then also maybe even educate people going forward about the importance of staying on top of your stuff, you know, watching your blood pressure, watching what you eat, all that kind of stuff?
Well, Chris, this is why I say that you're so much better than me. You're reaching much more people than I ever reach. Mm-hmm. I rarely even get to see our stroke survivors. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing is just unbelievable. And I think, you know, there's no better advocate for stroke than either somebody who's survived a stroke or a family member of somebody mm-hmm. who survived a stroke. And I think outreach is the best, right? One part of outreach is getting people to recognize, hey, you have to watch your blood pressure. You have to pay attention to these things. Mm-hmm. If you have diabetes, if you have people in your family that are diabetic and they're not paying attention to it, you got to get them to get out there and tell them how important it is and all the other risk factors as well. Stop smoking, get all that stuff. But I think there's another level, as you mentioned, the speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy. And you mentioned that, you know, as you said, there's a limitation on that, right? 3 weeks or whatever insurance mm-hmm. companies are providing. I think there's an outreach that we can do. That's going to be, you know, it's an untouched market in some sense. And I think that's probably the next step because we're saving people's lives, but even the ones we save are still having the disabilities. So the next step is going to be, what do we do after that? Mm-hmm. And physical therapy, I mentioned it to you before, physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, it's like voting in Chicago. Do it early and do it often. Mm-hmm. And these insurance companies that are limiting it, I think, you know, we could be better advocates mm-hmm. To reach out to these insurance companies to provide better support for this, for stroke survivors. We could donate to organizations. These are organizations that could use help, whether it's money or we're participating in it, mm-hmm. participating in the outreaches, and participating in more stroke support groups. The stroke support groups there's just a paucity mm-hmm. of support out there for stroke survivors. And in most hospitals, every hospital has a support group, but as you saw, they're really not well organized and they're right. not reaching out to people and they're not really providing the support that people need.
Right.
So I think those are some ways that we can improve the post-stroke recovery.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just am such an advocate for helping our caregivers. I mean, first of all, us stroke survivors would be nowhere without our caregivers. And, you know, to think that, again, you know, when the insurance cuts you off, you know, I mean, you're basically going to get maybe, you know, a month, month and a half, you know, 2 months if you're lucky in terms of any kind of, you know, assistance from your insurance company. And then you're dumped into a car by a candy striper and they just wave goodbye and off drives the caregiver. And they're like, whoa, wait, I got to, you know, get a 4-year degree now in, you know, PT and OT all within just a couple of weeks here and try to learn what the heck I need to do now to help my loved one, you know, get through the rest of their life. You know, that's one of the reasons why I created the Stroke Channel with, you know, having some informational videos on there. So maybe somebody who no longer has insurance, you know, they can watch the television network and, you know, we've got some, you know, therapists on there that do exercises and all that kind of stuff just to kind of help them get through. It's, you know, I don't know. Don't get me started on the insurance companies and stuff. I mean, I'm blessed to have.
You're absolutely right.
I think they could just do more at trying to help people get better. I mean, it seems like they'd save a lot more money that way if they just, you know, try to help, you know, end the problem rather than being part of the problem.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's a lot, there's always room to go on this. Unfortunately, you know, I'm very proud of our system and what we do post stroke, but there's always more room to grow. And you know, one problem is once you've gone through this, like you said, it's brand new to you. It's a complete life changing situation, and any support that has been provided sometimes gets lost by the patients.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, there's a lot of facilities that do not really provide a lot of that post-stroke care. And I think that is definitely somewhere we can work on.
Absolutely. 100%. You and I have talked about that a lot. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing this Stroke 101 series, because I've heard many, many times, especially with people that are part of our support group, that says, you know, man, you know, when my husband or wife, or whatever, was released from the hospital, I had no idea what, you know, what I needed to do. I mean, you know, some don't know that they need to prepare the house, you know, with grab bars,
right,
in the bathroom,
yeah,
and you know, all the stuff. I mean, they you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, all they know is,
well, it's
that,
overwhelming. It's
absolutely,
overwhelming.
100%. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, I've even had some say, you know, they're looking at their loved one, and where it takes three people to get them out of bed and into a wheelchair so they can go to the bathroom. But yet they were just told, oh, your husband's going home in a couple of days. And it's like, home? Wait, I just watched three people try to get him just into a wheelchair. It's just me and my kid. You know, what do you mean he's coming home, you know?
You know, leaving the hospital for any reason is overwhelming. Even I think about when I had my first child and they said, go home, and you're like, what am I going to do now? And mm-hmm. they've already gone through this checklist of things that we're supposed to do, and you lose it. It's totally overwhelming.
Sure.
And to have that situation for something like this, which is obviously much more profound,
right,
it's easily lost. But I think the follow-up, I think one thing that is drastically missing is the follow-up. And once the patients and the caregivers go home, there should be an automatic follow-up that goes over it again once some of this is kind of settling in their head. And I think a lot of that is missing. And,
right,
and more importantly, the physical therapy and the limitations on that.
Right.
We could do better at that.
And that certainly brings us to our next episode, because in our next episode, we are going to have some PTs and OTs and STs on that episode who are going to talk about, okay, so now your loved one is leaving the hospital and going to a rehab hospital. And so what happens there? How can you best utilize that precious time that you've got there getting rehabilitation before they're sent home and things like that? So that's kind of what this whole series is about, you guys, to try to kind of, you know, fill in some of the gaps that maybe you were never told about when you or your loved one was sent home following a stroke, or better yet, you know, unfortunately, but better yet, if you are currently in the hospital right now, either you or your loved one, and you know, you were like me 5 years ago, going on Dr. Google and Dr. YouTube with one hand, kind of like typing into my phone, like, what would they say, mom? Hemorrhagic? How did she spell it? And you know, you've got all these questions with no answers whatsoever. So at any rate, that's the whole purpose of all this. I would also like to add, and I'm going to put Superman on the spot a little bit, if any of you have any questions about anything you've heard here on the show today, maybe, you know, it's like, well, you know, thanks for the show, but you know, I was wondering, you know, here's my situation, blah blah blah, just drop us a line. You know, I can't promise you that Dr. Darflinger, aka Superman, will be able to take the time to answer them all, but I know that a lot of times there's questions or things that come up in a conversation like we're having now, and you know, maybe it kind of hit you kind of close to home, or you've got some questions about something that we've spoken about, you know, just kind of shoot an email. Just go to the strokechannel.tv website and shoot us an email, and maybe I'll try to get Superman on another call here one day and have him kind of answer some of that and you know, stuff like that. I hate to put you on the spot, Superman, but
I'm blessed to be part of this. Thank you. Yeah, anytime.
Yeah.
I usually respond pretty quick, so
yeah,
feel free.
I know how you roll, man. I know who you roll. So, man, I tell you, thanks so much for taking your time today to kind of hang out. I know we've been trying to do this a lot, but you've been busy being Superman, pulling clots out of people's heads and stuff. You've been a busy guy. And anyway, man, you know, I love you.
Thanks,
I love your family. And I'm sure you and I will be talking
to you
in the next day or
yeah,
so, and you know, trying to solve the world's problems, because you know, every day we're sending, man, did you read this today in the paper? Man, it's crazy. So anyway, I love you, bro.
You too, brother, man. Thanks for letting me participate. I really mean it.
Absolutely. Thanks, man. And everybody listening, thank you so much again for listening to the show and all the great feedback and everything else. You know, we're all brothers from another mother and you know, all that kind of stuff. So just know that, you know, we're here for you guys. We're just doing the best we can in this crazy thing called stroke. So anyway, I love you guys. Thanks so much for listening. Feel free to join us for our stroke support group, which is held every Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific time. Just go to the strokechannel.tv website and click on the link and you can join us and get plugged in and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's an email coming in right now. Again, I love you guys. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, there is still a beautiful life after stroke. This program is not to be used as a way to diagnose or treat any medical condition that you may have. Please consult your doctor or healthcare professional before making any changes to your current medical routine. Life After Stroke is a production of the Hang On to the Dream Foundation, the 501c3 nonprofit organization that helps kids and adults reach their goals in life. If these Life After Stroke programs are helpful to you, please consider making a tax-deductible donation to the Hang On to the Dream Foundation to assist the organization in its numerous outreach activities. For more information, just go to www.hangontothedream.org. And remember, no matter how hard things seem, hang on to the dream.